What you're about to hear was aired on Planet Philadelphia, environmental radio show on Germantown Community Radio, 92.9 FM, WGGTLP in Philadelphia, and on gtownradio.com.
Hi, everyone. This is Planet Philadelphia. I'm Kay Wood, the host. I'll be talking about the Farm Bill with Pennsylvania farmer Mike Kovach today. Hi, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Kay. I appreciate the opportunity.
I saw an op-ed you wrote about the Farm Bill, and that reminded me that, in fact, the Farm Bill has not yet been passed. And so we'll get into that a bit later. But if we could start out the show with you just saying a few words about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, I'm Michael Kovach. I'm from Mercer County, PA, right out on the Ohio line. We are a multiple species regenerative direct sale farm. So kind of doing what Pennsylvania farms are best at and direct selling right off the farm here. We raise Black Angus beef on grass only, pigs in the woods, we could silvopastured, pastured poultry through the summer months, and pastured eggs year round. Direct sale to folks who come up our driveway in my spare time, as if something like that could allow for spare time. I'm the president of Pennsylvania Farmers Union, and I'm an active advocate for family independent farmers here in the Commonwealth and nationwide.
And the Pennsylvania Farmers Union is?
Yes, it's a part of the National Farmers Union, which is the second largest membership ag organization in the country. It takes up a lot of time and energy. I mean, it's a passion project for sure. I was spurred to action by another friend who was president of Farmers Union back in the time when I joined the board, and just became really enamored of the idea of taking the message for small family farms like ours to the powers that be, and letting them know how what they're doing in DC or Harrisburg, how that affects us out on the land.
We're going to be talking about the Farm Bill, and many people don't realize it's such a big bill that covers many areas. So if you could tell people a bit about what it actually is and what it's supposed to do.
That's a huge question, okay? being honest, it's a huge omnibus. It's where I learned the term omnibus. So it's a giant bill. The projection that I read early in this year's negotiation was that this would be over a $1 trillion piece of legislation that covers a five-year period typically. Now, there's a reason that it expired in 2023, and that's because there was a situation like this not too long ago where it just got extended for a couple of years. You would think it would be on the O's and the fives, right? But it doesn't work out like that anymore. But unfortunately, we're delayed again. It's been extended. The current Farm Bill, which at least the super critical programs are somewhat protected for now, because about 76% of the Farm Bill spending in this last Farm Bill was for nutrition programs. So SNAP and WIC and all the things that a lot of folks rely on. That's the lion's share of Farm Bill's dollars are dedicated to that. So it's important for everybody, not just farmers. Definitely everybody who eats is impacted by the Farm Bill.
I like that. Everybody who eats.
Yeah.
Also, it has things like for conservation.
There are basically three other buckets. About 9% of the spending is on subsidized crop insurance. About 10% or so, or 12 maybe, is around the commodity program. And a similar percentage is dedicated to conservation. Around 10 or less percent is dedicated to conservation typically. So programs like the EQIP Fund, the Conservation Reserve Program. The Conservation Reserve Program is worth noting. It's one program on the farm here that we participate in. And we participate in a branch of that called CRP Grasslands. So it's incentive to keep perennial cover in perennial cover to dissuade you from plowing it up, which is exactly the opposite of what a lot of the other programs have done, unfortunately, over the decades. It's kind of pushed us toward a form of agriculture that maybe isn't doesn't make the most sense long term.
Talking about forms of agriculture, most of the agriculture in the US are big industrial farms, and they help feed a whole lot of people. But some people have said there are some real downsides to that sort of farming. So I was wondering if you could give us your ideas.
Yeah, huge downsides. Honestly, we've extracted from the soils to the point where nothing will grow there without the inputs that very often break family farmers. They become reliant on. It's become a racket at many levels. The seed companies, there are three seed companies that control majority of the seed. You know, a similar number of agrochemical companies. And it's really driving the type of agriculture that we're partaking in here in the United States. Instead of looking at a big picture, how are we going to be able to continue to do this 100 years from now or 50 years from now? We look at, well, what's going to make me more money next year? Is it going to be corn or soybeans? And we've gone from a system that incentivized rotating corn, then soybeans, then wheat, then 3 years of perennial cover, whether that be a hay field or a pasture, to a rotation that now is most often corn and soy, then corn and soy. If corn's high, corn. We've created a system that incentivizes their own practices. And what we're hoping that they'll do with this $18 billion that was set aside in the IRA for conservation funding within the Farm Bill, or it wasn't specific to Farm Bill. What we're hoping is that that will allow for a lot more folks to participate in programs that incentivize perennial cover, that incentivize cover crops on the ground. Whether if we're going to continue to have conventional agriculture be the main driver of our ag system, we need to do it in a much more responsible way. And putting dollars into the hands of the folks that can enact these practices is tantamount. It's paramount importance. We've got to really kind of take another look at where our tax dollars are going and what practices are we incentivizing and perpetuating and making even worse. You know, we need to get off of the synthetic fertilizer treadmill, which I could expound on a lot if you ever wanted. We don't do any elemental synthetic nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, the big three there, the NPK. We don't do any of that on any of our ground. Instead, we use the manure from our chickens fertilizes our hay fields. The pigs are clearing out the understory in the woods and making more silvopasture for our cattle while being extraordinarily happy and tasty pigs. There's a million different ways we can get to the end of feeding the world. We're overproducing these commodities grossly, like to the tune of let's figure out things to do with it. So about 50% of the corn in the United States is dedicated to animal feed.
A lot of the corn is also used to produce ethanol, I think.
Absolutely. About 40% of the corn is devoted to ethanol most recently. On paper, in a reductionist way, looking at, you know, what makes more emissions when you burn it coming out of the tailpipe, ethanol, there's a case to be made for it. And I'm not altogether against ethanol. I think if we could do ethanol, if we can do it in such a way that we're building soil as opposed to extracting from soil and keeping soil on life support with expensive inputs that, again, you can't save your seed anymore because it's patented. And if you do and you're caught at it, you're ruined. The system, we've painted ourselves really into a corner with practices, legislation, where our tax dollars are funding. We went fast, cheap, and easy, right? In the big picture, it's going to cost us more in the long run in our ability to continue to feed ourselves, and in our health of our populace, obviously, is taking a hit. There's very clear correlation between the rise of industrial agriculture and the decline of the human condition in the United States, and unfortunately spreading worldwide these days. You know, they're cutting down and burning down rainforests to do what the Americans are doing, so they don't have to buy our corn and soy. One of the most insidious parts is that it causes farmers to root against other farmers, I think, in a lot of instances when you get a commoditized food system like that. So, you know, when there's a bad weather in Brazil and there are mudslides and everything like that, there's gleeful cheers that, hey, look at how good our soybean market's going to be next year. It's unfortunate, but that's where we're at.
When you talked about mudslides in Brazil, that kind of backs into the question of climate change. And in your op-ed, you mentioned that you saw on your farm a lot of effects from climate change.
Yeah,
So,
we're fortunate in Northwest Pennsylvania, at least, in that the effects so far has been to very much moderate our winters. And we're at the southern edge of the Lake Erie snow belt. So lake effect snows are pretty common around here. We usually get about 60 inches of snow a year. Last year, we got less than 20. That's a big moisture deficit to start the year with. 40 inches of snow makes a lot of groundwater. And especially in a system that's got the ability to capture water. Interesting statistic about organic matter, which is one of the things that we deplete from the soil by this excessive monoculture, repeated tillage and chemical inputs and all these things. It breaks down the soil organic matter to the point where there's none in there. Well, it turns out that that's one of the big things for retaining water. So it makes the ground very vulnerable to drought. When it's been repeatedly worked and broken down, and there's a low soil organic matter content. For every 1% that you increase soil organic matter, you increase the ground's capacity to hold water by about 25,000 gallons. That's quite a lot of rain that, to give that away in the name of let's do this again because that's the way we always do it, is extremely frustrating for me to see. Because my ditch is full of the neighbor's topsoil. I'm down the hill from a lot of agriculture that relies on tillage, repeated tillage. I'm seeing we're not freezing here like we did. We haven't had a frozen ground in, for more than a couple of days in 3 years plus now. And I just shared a Facebook post from 10 years ago that it was the forecast had been upgraded from 24 below to 15 below this time of year, and we're just we're it's moderate, but again, started out with a 40-inch snow deficit, and then it didn't rain at all in May. We always have a lot of rain in May. We had zero rain in May. So our first cutting of hay was off. It was a little short, but wanted to get it off so we'd make a good second cutting after the rains in May came, and they never came. So an end of June and part into July, and then September was completely dry. So it's a problematic in that it's made less predictable the weather patterns that we've come to expect over the years. In the big picture, on the one thing that we have to grow all of our food in is coincidentally the one carbon sink on the planet over which we have even a modicum of control. That soil organic matter is carbon at the end of the day. So keeping that resource that's all of ours actively sequestering carbon is key to any discussion about climate change. And it's very often absent to my great chagrin because, there are a few carbon sinks, but only one that we can do anything about. So if we're growing our food in a smarter way, we might well be mitigating climate change at the same time. At least we're building resiliency in that ground to the effects of climate change. So
Okay.
there's no way you can turn and find a loss there. Unless you are a big agrochemical or agri-seed company with professional lobbyists on staff.
The negotiations are ongoing for the new farm bill. What are the things you'd like to see?
Sure. I mean, it's such an enormous piece of legislation that anybody that says they know everything that's in it is probably lying to you, including the folks who craft it and vote on it. And they'll tell you that. But some of the small changes that I've seen recently, that subsidized crop insurance that I was talking about, that sort of drives the decision to plant certain crops or farm certain ways. And in fact, there are requirements within some of those for, spray and herbicide and synthetic inputs. And I had just discovered last year an insurance product that's subsidized similarly by the same bucket of money, I guess, within the farm bill for forage and rangeland protection. It's basically what we do. So when we have a year like last year, where we get one third of the hay that we normally get, and one third of the grazing days on our pastures that we'd normally get, we have some recompense. Currently, right now, out of pocket buying hay for the year, because I just didn't make enough to feed our herd. I mean, it takes a lot of hay to get them through the winter in Northwest Pennsylvania, for one thing, and to fatten them up on nothing but grass, it takes quite a lot of hay. So when we have a year like last year, we're taking a financial hit. Thankfully, we were able to mitigate it somewhat with a couple of late cuttings. And I talked a neighbor into allowing me to cover crop a wheat field he had just taken the wheat off of. I said, "Hey, what are you planting there? Corn." I said, "Well, what if I was to plant clover in there this fall and then take a late cutting? And then you'd get the benefit of that clover having grown there all winter, nitrogen for you, because they say when red clover flowers, it's fixed 100 pounds of nitrogen per acre." Well, that's a number that a conventional farmer can look at and go, "Well, that's a reduction in my fertilizer bill." Hopefully the neighbor will see the benefit of that red clover having been on that ground all winter and fixed nitrogen. And I'm trying, still fingers crossed, I'm trying to talk him into no-tilling his corn straight into the living crop after we make a cutting in the spring. Because again, that helps me out, but it also is a great illustration for him of, look what happens when you just, instead of burning it down with glyphosate and then tilling it and then planting your corn with no-till equipment, why not just use the no-till equipment? What, you just drive through there with corn seeder and plant. He's got conservation corn planter, which is meant for no-tilling, basically.
What else would you like to see in the bill? Is there something you'd like more research on?
Absolutely. More research into these techniques that we're talking about. At the end of the day, it's regenerative agriculture. To just quantify, we're talking a lot about carbon credits and all these things for folks. If this is a way to accelerate it without putting some GMO bacterium into the ground, I just read an article the other day that was pretty shocking and kind of really a gut punch, wherein there is technology being developed to genetically engineer one specific bacterium in the soil to help in various ways. So there's an acknowledgement that life in the ground is important, but only if there's a profit to be made at it.
As you said, the farm bill is huge. What would you suggest people do to learn more, just for the average person?
There are a lot of resources out there. National Farmers Union, Pennsylvania Farmers Union, both have news articles relative to that.
What's the URL on that?
It's pafarmersunion.org, or the National Farmers Union website is nfu.org.
Do you suggest that people contact their legislators about the farm bill?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've forgotten very often in the United States that we're supposed to be the ones telling our congressmen what's what out here. And we don't. At the end of the day, we let it to somebody else. Well, if somebody is going to show up for a meeting with a different idea than me, then their idea is going to be the one that wins. And when we're talking about big food or big ag, they're very well funded and have professional staffs of folks just to go around and meet with congressional staffers. But I will tell you that nothing that those guys can say can hold a candle to a family farmer or a constituent of any sort sitting right across from a congressman and telling them how it is. There is no comparison. And any one of them will tell you that. They need to hear what we've got to say. Now, it doesn't always mean they're going to agree with us, but that's okay. That doesn't mean they're bad people. That doesn't mean we're bad people. We're just kind of there to do what we can. And it's extremely important for every American to get in front of their representatives.
All right, well, thank you so much.
If you want to know more about Planet Philadelphia, go to planetphiladelphia.com. You could also find out more about other G-Town Radio programming by going to gtownradio.com. I hope you will consider making a small monthly donation to help Planet Philadelphia continue presenting interviews on important underreported environmental topics and exploring their complexities and intersections. Thank you so much for your support.